child, Katie said, a heat under her eyes. You'll do anything for her. This is the last time, Mr. Watts, she said, opening the screen door for him. I promise. The hush the antibiotics brought on. Drew was sound asleep in his bed, his hands still sticky from salt, too. I just have to get Devon, and I'll be back.
You don't have to explain, Mr. Watts said, stepping inside. You never did.
3 miles into the 28-mile drive to Bellstar, she caught sight of the original Weaver's wagon, the only one where the wheels on the sign really turned, where Ryan had been a line cook, and where Gwen had her office. Her fancy leather-bound checkbook binder, her sterling silver check-signing pen. The truck in front of her slowed and turned into its lot. Night Owl Distributors, beer, fine wine, distilled spirits. Its orange logo was a pair of owl eyes, one winking tipsily. It looked familiar. Where had she seen it before? Then it came to her. Just a few days ago, the doodle on Eric's notepad as he talked to Gwen. A pair of slanty eyes, a V between them like a cartoon owl. Behind the wheel, the driver wore a cap with the same logo. He looked familiar, too. She watched as he drove through the lot to the restaurant's loading area, and she followed. Iced coffee in hand, Gwen stood on the loading dock as the men emptied the Night Owl truck, and another one, a side of beef painted blistering pink on the side, pulled up. The driver walked over to her, clipboard outstretched. Squinting, Katie watched him, his dew-lapped face, and the ambling way he moved. Tugging at his cap, he looked just like he had when Katie had first seen him at the police station, holding the door for Helen Beck, tipping his brim at her.
"Did you see his hat?"
Drew had asked Katie when they spotted him in the parking lot of the police station.
"It had two eyes on it, and one was droopy. It made his face look droopy."
He held Gwen's coffee while she signed the form, rocking foot to foot just like Uncle Don.
"Here's a fella. Been arrested twice for drinking Jack Daniels while under the influence of driving. Used to deliver for Gwen Weaver, and she fired his sorry ass."
Gwen handed him the clipboard, and he saluted her and climbed leisurely into the truck's cab. Lifting her coffee, she seemed to salute him back. Slamming her car door, Katie bolted across the parking lot toward Gwen. She didn't know what she was doing, but she was doing it.
"Who is he?" she shouted, jabbing her finger at the truck. "Who is he? You know him, don't you?"
Gwen's mouth twitched slightly, but she covered it with her coffee, then smiled.
"Paul? Sure. I own 6 restaurants, 3 with liquor licenses. I know all the Night Owl guys."
"I saw him, Gwen, at the police station. He's the witness, isn't he? The trucker who said he saw a purple car."
Gwen beckoned her inside through the kitchen, with its squall of clanging pots, chugging machines, through the swinging double doors into the empty quiet of the dining area.
Lunch service cleared, save one remaining tub of dishes, slithering with grease. "Katie," she said quietly, looking down into the bin for a moment. "I don't know what you're talking about. You seem upset.
You seem upset a lot lately. Very dramatic and interesting. What is it today? Diphtheria? Smoke inhalation? I heard you conducted a little Olympic torch ritual in your backyard."
"How did you know about—" "God damn it, Gwen," Katie said. "I talked to the Belfors. That guy's the witness who claimed he saw Haley, right? The one who got it all wrong? And he used to work for you. And now he does again."
She squinted at Katie, cocked her head. "I'm a firm believer in second chances," she said, just as she'd said about Ryan. "It's the American way."
"Gwen, what is this? Did you pay him off?" Katie asked. "Did you pay him to lie?
Do you want me to tell Teddy that?"
Gwen paused, then let out a sigh. She never had been patient. She didn't know how.
"I didn't tell him to say it was a purple car," she said, shaking her head. "In fact, I think I suggested blue, generic. Purple was Paul's embroidery. Turned out he doesn't like Haley. She was a careless driver. Ran into one of his hand trucks in our lot once. I wasn't going to pay for the 4 cases of old granddad, so he had to. Anyway, He happens to have some debt.
Gwen, I don't care. Debt really runs this country, doesn't it?
Maybe you know something about that.
Everyone wants more than they can pay for.
Can you blame them? He needed money. He needed my business. He was willing to do something to get it.
It was so bold, so stark. Katie nearly leaned back from it, the bald admission.
For Bellstars?
For all of us.
And you would have just let that train keep going?
Let Haley go to prison?
I doubt it would have come to that, but it gave us time.
And would you have preferred the alternative? Gwen said, tilting her head and squinting at her.
Is that what you want, Katie? The police looking elsewhere, finding suspects? Motives? What exactly do you want here? You'd better be sure this is a conversation you really want to have.
Katie looked down at the table, its bleach-streaked whorls. She thought of Eric on the phone with her, the two of them plotting together. It was like finding him in bed with her, with anyone, naked and ugly. It was worse. Why it was worse, she didn't know. It was.
I don't want you near my daughter again, she said, or my husband.
Gwen smiled dimly, leaning against one of the booths.
You can make me the bad guy if you want, she said. The tiger mom, the rich bitch, the husband stealer, that one's flattering, but I never got my kicks that way. I know where I want my energies invested, and Eric does too.
She looked at Katie, eyes narrow and crackling.
You don't know anything about him, Katie said,
tight and low, but every word like a scream in her ear.
He brought you in for your sacks of cash. He works to keep you here for them.
Gwen's face loosened a split second, a jolt of surprise or hurt.
Look at you, she said. Well, I may not know everything about Eric, but I know about you. You've always wanted to play the selfless mom, the good sport. The one with the kid whose talents just fell in your lap, like she was born a gold medalist and you just stood on the sidelines and clapped. But we both know it isn't like that.
Stay out of my daughter's business. You have. What I have are resources.
As you kindly pointed out, that's why you brought me on. That's why that smart, ambitious husband of yours found me, courted me, won my favor so I could pull out my checkbook and make sure that racehorse of ours keeps running.
My daughter's not your goddamned horse. She's not anyone's horse.
Gwen smiled, leaning back farther, resting her hand on the banquette behind her.
But none of it works without a Devon, she said. A Devon lifts up the gym, raises everyone's game. Gives all those parents the delusion that they, too, could produce a Devon.
A hot gust blew from the swinging kitchen doors, but Katie felt herself shiver.
She's not a Devon. She's my Devon, and she's not there to serve anyone else's fantasies.
Gwen lifted an eyebrow, blonde and precise.
And this isn't a problem to solve like a failing coach, bad equipment, Katie continued. A boy died. A boy we all knew.
Gwen sighed, her eyes returning to the ketchup-slicked dish bin beside them.
A boy died. Yes. A pretty boy, who made us all feel prettier.
She paused a moment, then looked back at Katie. Looked at her like she'd look at Lacey, and Lacey would tighten her braids.
And from what Ron Wrigley tells me, the police stop investigating these hit-and-run cases in a few days. I mean, a few paint chips. What do they mean?
They locked eyes for a moment. A moment that seemed to crackle and buzz between them. What they both knew and neither would say. Finally, Gwen opened that perfectly painted mouth of hers.
You haven't asked me. But I really don't know what happened to poor Ryan Beck that night. It's not my business. All I know is it was my daughter's birthday.
What does that have to do with anything?
Lacey was so glad Devon came to the party. It meant a lot.
Gwen, it was a shame she had to leave before we even got to the presents.
Though Devon's gift was very nice, Lacey wears those glitter bracelets constantly, even if they make her wrists itch.
Devin doesn't enjoy parties,
Katie said, the words coming automatically, not liking the feeling, the sound, the prickly edge of this.
She never stays for long.
She got a call right before she left. She sounded very anxious on the phone. But she promised she'd find a way out, that's what she said. I guess she did find a way out.
The bad feeling, it was growing. You just follow my daughter around, do you?
That's all any of you do. Do you think Devin has time for your little girl parties? Hearing herself, her tone, the thickness of everything, Katie felt queasy.
I saw her through the front window, charging down the lawn like it was the vault runway, Gwen continued.
I called after her. It didn't seem safe at night, but she's very fast, as you know. Lacey should sprint with half her power. A loud crash from the kitchen, the sounds of bottles rolling, breaking. Luckily, you don't live very far. She was moving with great purpose, as if she had someplace she needed to be. I was the only one who saw her. She paused, looking at Katie. But no one will ever hear it from me.
There's nothing to hear, Katie said. But in her head, she was picturing it all. Her daughter dashing through the night. Those soundless sneakers, all stealth and speed.
Gwen nodded, as if she could hear Katie's thoughts. Katie, don't mistake me. I know my horse in this race, she said. We all do.
My daughter?
Katie repeated. Is not a fucking horse. What I'm saying is don't worry, Katie. I'm taking care of it.
That's what I'm here for. To protect your investment?
Isn't that what parents do? Gwen said, smiling.
When we're young, we don't know what we want. We're blobs.
We need shaping.
She's shaping herself, Katie said. No one ever understood.
Gwen shook her head. They think they want things, tits, sexy boyfriends, McGriddles every weekend, but they don't really know what these things mean. That's why we've got to want things for them, Katie. The right things.
I'm not like you, Katie said. I'm nothing like you.
Gwen just smiled. It's funny. Teddy always says girl gymnasts are like horses. High strung, she said. I was never a gymnast, couldn't even do a cartwheel, but horses.
Well, I rode horses from the time I was 5, every day for years. And here you are, still trying to ride horses.
My dad loved them, Gwen said, not seeming to have heard. He used to take me to the stables every day. My whole world was saddles, hay, bridles, and bits. Chantilly, that was my first horse, a ravishing OTTB mare.
As she spoke, her face turned younger. Softer.
When I got her, she was lame on the right. Dad showed me how to use a rasp on her. File the flaring, nip the crack. After that, she never put a foot wrong. I rode her all the way to the Jubilee. My dad was so nervous he bit the tip of his tongue clean off when I won.
She looked at Katie, shaking herself from the reverie, or trying to. It's important that we do that, she said.
That's important, Katie.
Do what? Gwen, you're...
Whenever I doubted myself, my dad would say, grab that dream by the hands, Gwenny. Clutch until the knuckles go white.
Whose dream?
It doesn't matter whose dream it is, she said.
Just that it's a dream.
Katie stared down at her hands, the rock salt still under her nails. There were many things she wanted to say, like that she'd never had a dream for Devin, had only followed her daughter's desires. But then her thoughts snagged on that word, desire. That word that was all over Devin's essay, desire. Desire. Now it is only desire that rules me. Whatever desire meant to Devin. Whatever it had done to her.
Gwen, you're wrong, Katie said, about everything. And this gym, you boosters, all of this, it's poison. It's poisoned everything. I'm going to Bellstar's now, and I'm taking my daughter away from all the poison of that poisonous place.
And you and Eric were delicate virgins when you arrived at Bellstar's all those years ago, right? Katie, that just doesn't fly with me. Eric made the boosters. The two of you are Bell Stars.
Not anymore, Katie said.
You'll see how little we need you.
The bell over the front door rang, and Gwen's gaze turned to it, the older couple walking inside. And Gwen, Katie said, I'm sorry your daughter's second rate. Second string. I'm sorry she'll never be your elite, your thoroughbred. Her legs aren't strong enough, and soon practice won't matter anymore. It was as if Gwen didn't hear, and the customers arriving at the hostess station, Gwen's eyes landed instead on the dish tub with the ketchup lapped up one side. She shook her head.
Heather! Jeff! She shouted, so loud and so sudden Katie nearly jumped. Come get the fucking tub! Get the fucking tub now!
I'm nothing like you, Katie said again, wanting to say it 100 times.
Gwen turned, looking at Katie. No, she said, a grim tug to her mouth. You're much better.
I changed my mind, Katie said. I want him with me.
Mr. Watts nodded as if it made some kind of sense, helping Katie rouse Drew from his sickly slumber, tug on his coat.
Where are we going, Mom?
The gym.
Okay.
Mr. Watts followed her outside, Drew lagging behind, resting on the porch steps, tying his shoes.
Are you okay?
Mr. Watts looked at her. She had no idea what he saw.
Thanks for watching him.
I like him. I don't need any thanks.
Mr. Watts,
she said, looking at Drew on the front steps, pulling at the tongue on his sneakers.
You said something before about the day Devin got hurt. The mower?
I did.
That you saw me? You said you saw me.
Standing at the screen door, you had your hands over your ears because of the mower. You were watching her run to her daddy.
You always loved to watch her run.
You're remembering it wrong, she said. I wasn't at the door. I was in the kitchen and I heard the scream. Then I ran to the door. It was over by the time I got there, so you had it wrong.
He looked at her. Her key is jingling in her hand, her body fixed and tight. She didn't move.
Well, he said, blinking slowly. My memory isn't what it used to be.
No.
Memory can be a funny thing, he added softly.
You ready, Drew?
She called out, voice rasping. He rose, and then began running toward her.
Safe drive, Mrs. Knox,
Mr. Watts said, as she hurried Drew to the car.
You be safe. Okay?
On the ride, she let Drew sit beside her in the front seat. She was thinking of the first time she'd ever visited Bell Stars. Walking into that hallowed space. Seeing all those girls, the older ones, impossibly strong and fresh-faced, practice their floor routines, the music echoing from the old boombox Teddy used to use. Russian folk songs, high opera, tragic arias, erotic tangos. Bouncing, running, diving, propelling themselves into the air to music grim, dramatic, melancholic, carnal. At the time, she'd thought how strange it was, all these little girls performing to such adult songs, songs about things they couldn't possibly understand, songs of desire, longing, sorrow, passion, loss. What did they know of such feelings, the big emotions of life? Slowly, Katie and Drew walked up the stands, to their usual spot, 13J. She didn't look at the other parents, the boosters. But she could hear them behind her, whispering excitedly, pointing and cheering and chattering and pant-hooting about the new beam coach, how 3 of her girls earned top spots on beam at the last qualifier, and how Teddy must have poached her from M-Power. What a coup! On the floor, bodies were moving, bounding, swooping, flicking, spinning. Girls on the ropes, climbing with ferocity. Girls on the bars, swinging layout flyaways, straddlebacks. Baby giants. As if nothing had happened. As if the last 10 days had been a fever dream.
Do I see sickled feet, Missy?
A familiar voice rumbled.
Because those are deductions, my dear. The ugliest kind.
Coach T, feet planted on a stack of orange mats, face red, mouth open. Just a few hours before,
He had been sitting across from her, pleading his case, pledging his troth. And now here he was, along with Amelie's and Bobby V and two new coaches, both with necks as thick as tree stumps, their log arms flipping girl after girl, their voices low and steady and constant.
Swing! Swing! Come on, strong! Strong! Come on, fivers! That's sad juice! Garbage in, garbage out! Work your arms in the double lay, Cheyenne! Work straight! Head up, head up!
All the shouts and grunts and squeaks, hands slamming on the beam, feet punching the mat, the hiccup of the vault, the squeeze of the springs.
Big smiles, no mistakes, little Miss Weaver.
Come on, Jordan, arms, arms, arms! Sell, girl, sell, perform!
Don't let me see it hurt. Remember, everything's beautiful, nothing hurts.
Everything was beautiful, and nothing hurt. Katie felt the words shiver through her. And it was that moment she saw Devin taking the beam, Teddy on the floor, approaching her. Devin leaning down, hands on her knees, listening to him, nodding. That's my daughter, she thought. Look at her. Look at that fawn-eyed little girl. She would never harm anyone. She would never do any of these things. It's not possible, she thought. Drew's wrong. Gwen's wrong. Everyone's wrong. She knew he'd arrive the minute she saw Devin straighten her spine, lengthen her form, shift her center ever so slightly to the rear of the gym. Katie turned, and there Eric was, standing just inside the doors on the far end of the stands. Face gaunt, hollow, eyes russet-ringed, he was watching Devin, hand shoved in his jeans pockets. The same jeans from last night, the knees darkened with dust. The ground beneath the two of them was gone, and might be gone forever. The eternal aerial, the falling forever. Abruptly, he looked up into the stands. Catching his gaze, she couldn't remember how she was supposed to feel or understand any of it. That's the awfulness of love, her mom once said to her, peeling off last night's eyelashes, resting them on the table beside her coffee. Every feeling, all at once, all the time. That's when you know it's real. And by then it's too late. Her head darting between the two, Katie's eyes unfocused, and husband and daughter blurred, the same dark hair, the same hooded eyes, the same fixed jaw, mouths like bruises. They were like twins, or the same thing. She knew she should be thinking, look what they've done. Look what she's done, and why. And look what he's done in hiding it. Hiding her. But instead, all she could think was, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you share it with me, either of you? It's always been we three, collaborators, conspirators. We three against the world. We four, she corrected herself. Drew beside her, head down in his book, Hardy Boys again, The Secret of the Caves. On the floor, all the girls, all the coaches had stopped mid-drill. Devin was at the vault.
Come on, Missy. Let's see that double twist Yurchenko, Teddy said, clapping his hands. You've done that one in your sleep before. No going backward here.
On the runway, Devin bobbed from foot to foot, clenching and unclenching her hands.
She nearly took a header on it last week,
murmured Jim Chu, Molly shushing him. Shaking her fingers at her sides now, Devin was talking to herself, staring at the springboard, 80 feet away. Then, as if she'd heard something, Devin lifted her head and looked over at her dad, locked eyes with him. And just like that, everything changed. As far away as Katie was, she could feel the change. Devin's chest filling, her body battening itself. Her head turning again, Devin looked up at Katie. Like a foot to the ribcage it was. Katie nearly lost her breath from the pain and power of it. My girl. The minute Devin exploded into her run, Katie closed her eyes. Look at her go, someone said behind her. Kirsten Seifert, her body inching forward. Would you look? Hearing the thunk of the springboard, opening her eyes, seeing it, springing what looked like 100 feet in the air, then landing, both heels thumping the mat with such force that 16 rows up, Katie could feel the shock up her spine. You can't understand what it's like,
until you see your child do something you could never do. No one could ever do.
This is what fearlessness looks like, Katie thought. What desire can do.
God, Jim Chu muttered. She's like a machine. Perfect machine. Do you ever want to open up that head of hers and see what kind of wiring she has?
My daughter's not a machine, Katie said. She's extraordinary.
Where'd Dad go?
Drew whispered. Touching her ribs, the phantom bruise from Devon's phantom kick, she peered out to the double doors. But Eric was gone. Back down on the floor, Devon was waving up at her, her face streaked white, those dark eyes. A face ghostly and exultant.
Mom,
she seemed to be calling out.
Mom, I did it!
She was smiling.
27 years ago, when Tina and I opened Bell Stars,
Teddy began, assembling everyone at practice's close.
It was basically a garage. We had to drag big fans across the concrete to keep the girls from fainting. Well, to keep me from fainting. Eventually, we moved to a church basement with a swamp cooler, then an old ballroom with warped wood, three floors in a warehouse. All before finally breaking ground a decade ago on what is now a state-of-the-art facility. And you may have noticed something about this facility. Look up.
All eyes lifted upward, to the suspended light banks and timber beams and far beyond.
You may think you see a ceiling, Teddy said, but your eyes deceive you, my friends. There is no ceiling. Bell Stars has no ceiling. No ceiling, no roof, no limits. Your dreams are ours. Our only limits are the skies, the heavens. Am I right?
The applause came fast and loud, ebullient. 100 ripped palms slapping, 100 pounding parent feet in the stands.
And look at us today,
he continued, turning toward Devon, beckoning her over.
Despite recent distractions, or perhaps because of them, as we return from them stronger, more committed, we are on a miraculous path because, after all, today we are in the presence of a future Olympian.
Head dazed and wobbling like a drunken sailor, Devon walked over to him, his bare arm encircling around her, usurping her, tucking her in his chest's deep pocket. The claps and cheers and raised hands, they were everywhere. Parents rising, draped jackets slipping from their arms, hats off, cheering and shouts, the girls on the floor yelling, twirling grip tape, unfurling wild streamers of it in the air. Jordan Seifert and Dominique Plonsky bent down and hoisted arms full of foam cubes from the pit, hurling them in the air, a ticker tape jubilee. That pit which had brought Ryan into their world. And finally, the frenzy, nearly at its peak, parents stomping in the stands till they shook, Lacey Weaver ran to the chalk bowl, plunging arms in, lifting them toward Devon, the chalk atomizing, covering Devon like confetti, like snow. Screaming now, all of them crowding her, their hands white, their bodies too, surrounding her, crushing her, swallowing her whole. A panic in Devon's eyes. Katie was sure she saw it before the swarm of arms and ponytails blocked her view. Devon, 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 do it for us. Devon, we're counting on you. Devon, do it. Chapter 21. It was nearly 9 o'clock when practice ended. Everyone else, all the boosters, all the girls, were decamping for a chilly dinner at Teddy's house to mark his triumphant return.
Aren't you coming?
Cheyenne Chu shouted at Devon from across the parking lot.
We're going home, Katie said, grabbing Devon's shoulder. Right away.
Devon looked at her, her face darkening.
What about Dad?
Why isn't Dad here?
Drew said when they got home, drive-through tacos seeping onto the kitchen table.
He's not coming home, Katie said, looking at Devon.
They locked in a long, complicated gaze.
I'm not hungry,
Devon said, running up the stairs before Katie could stop her.
I'm taking a shower.
Is it because of what I told you? Drew asked. Because Devon's here. She's allowed to be here because...
No, that's not why.
Mom,
he said. I'll never tell again, I promise.
The graveness in his face. Someone who'd witnessed horrors and miracles and knew how to endure them.
True, Katie said. I'm sorry.
For what?
For everything.
Everything before. Everything to come. She knew Devon was talking to Eric on her phone. Katie could hear her through the bathroom door. She was in there a long time, and Katie could hear her pacing, her voice high and inaudible. Finally, she came out.
Mom,
she said, her face marked where the phone had been, like a stamp, a seal.
You don't understand. You've got it wrong about Dad. Whatever you think, you're wrong.
Katie looked at her, waited for more. Devon's mouth was open, but she couldn't seem to make the words come. As if to say it would mean she would turn to stone. Maybe they all would.
We're a sick house, Katie had warned the police. I have a sick house.
We'll talk in the morning, Katie said, because she needed to think. Drew was lying flat on his bed, staring at the ceiling, the peeling nearly gone from his face. The new face was sneaking in, making its presence known. A different face. An older face. She gave him his antibiotics with juice.
Good night, Mom,
he said, swallowing the pills, reaching for the secret of the caves.
I think I'll be done tomorrow.
In the dream, she was sitting in the bleachers and her stomach hurt. Eric's hands were on it, rubbing it. But the pain got worse and worse. Pressing down, she could feel something inside, just beneath her navel. Eric's head to her belly, he told her he heard something, a grunt, a snarl. And that's when she felt a sharp tugging, like teeth, a tail flapping. Looking down between her legs, she saw it. Tawny fur, black stripe, a tiger's paw, claws unsheathed. Katie's own voice woke her, a strangled cry, her head jerking up, her body lifting, running from itself.
There's something in the bed. There's something in me.
Turning, she saw Devon standing in the doorway.
Mom?
Stepping inside the bedroom. Katie turned away. In the dark, her daughter's face was like a black hood. Behind her, she heard the footfalls on the carpet, a shush of bed covers lifting. Devon sliding in bed beside her, next to her, breathing quickly, her body shuddering as if with heat and horrors.
Have you ever done something so awful?
Devon asked.
Devon.
A moment passed, Katie listening to her breathe, waiting. Finally.
I have to tell you, Mom.
Tell me, Katie said.
Just tell me.
She did love him, maybe. But she wasn't sure what that meant, and did anyone ever know? She'd never had a boy even talk to her before. It was after a bad practice. Coach had yelled at her. Everyone saw. She couldn't make her body do the things it was supposed to do. Everything felt like it was falling apart. Ryan saw her hiding under the bleachers. He said,
if you ever need someone to talk to.
And explained he'd been a basketball player in high school. A good one. Everyone told him he'd get a scholarship. He didn't. He liked pot. Liked to party. He went to juvie instead.
It's hard, he told her, when everyone wants it so much, but you're the only one who has to do it.
The first time it happened was in the back of the restaurant, on the slumped sofa in the manager's office. The huff of the oven, blazing from 12 hours of use, the spray and gush of the dishwasher, the red-hot blink of a voicemail on the manager's phone.
Mom, she said now, everyone tells you how much it'll hurt, but it didn't hurt at all.
She was so focused on her own body, on what she was doing, on what was happening to every muscle, every nerve, that she nearly missed the look on his face, the flush that came over him, his shoulders shaking.
Mom, it was so exciting,
Devon said now, clutching her mom's arm.
All of it.
I know, Katie said. After he covered his face in his hands, she thought he might be crying. He said he wasn't, and turned away.
She had seen many men cry, Coach T, after a very good meet, or a very bad one. A dozen dads, including Jim Chu, who'd cried when Cheyenne landed on her head during a tumbling run. Even Bobby V, when he'd moved the uneven bars an inch without telling anyone and two girls fell. And your dad, Katie thought, on the freshly sheared grass of the yard. But Devin couldn't possibly remember.
It's not because I'm sorry, Ryan said. It's because I'm not.
The next time Devin saw a man cry was 6 weeks later, when her dad told her he'd found out. He wouldn't say how he knew, but he said it was his job to warn her that she was throwing everything away, that Teddy would never forgive her, that everything would change, that the biggest mistake you can make in life is giving in to sex. All the things you do when you're young seem temporary, but they're all forever, he told her. And there's 100 ways sex can ruin you. That became the thought she couldn't get out of her head.
I felt sick all the time, Devin said to Katie. What Dad said made it seem different, feel different. Like I'd maybe ruined everything already, and qualifiers were coming.
She had nightmares he was chasing her through thick woods. She could hear him breathing behind her, panting after her. He had long teeth like a vampire and wanted to drain her of all her blood. She dreamed he was choking her. She woke up panting for air. But she couldn't figure out how to end things.
I thought maybe I'd be in love like Haley, she said, like the girls at school. But it wasn't ever like that. It was just a thing I was trying.
The call came when she was at Lacey's party. Pedicures underway, rows of girls with their toes turned in, red and cracked and deformed.
Skip the party, he'd said. Can you sneak the car out again?
She'd said she couldn't. She didn't want to do that anymore.
My dad knows, she kept telling him. I have to stop.
It's important, he said.
And Devin crept into one of the Weaver bedrooms, Lacey's party favor wrappers strewn across the floor. It was hard to hear him because he was outside. He was walking on the road.
I need to see you.
And he told her he'd just broken up with Haley. It wasn't fair to her, what they were doing. It's someone else, Haley had said, and she was very angry and very loud. He told her no, but he didn't think she believed him. He'd driven her home in her car, and now he was walking, and he wondered if it was time to tell her the truth. Tell everyone that he and Devin were in love, and it was real, and they weren't ashamed.
But I don't love you, she thought. And it's not real, and I am ashamed.
And that neither of them cared about the consequences. The panic in her chest, like a bird trapped there, flapping. But he said she was just scared and not to worry.
Pick me up at our spot, Ash Road.
A spot that mattered to him, the spot he'd seen her running that time and given her a ride.
It's dangerous here, he'd said. Jesus, you could die. Meet me, he said. It'll all be okay.
It was like his hands were closing around her neck. Everyone would know. Coach T would never forgive her. Everything would be over. Slipping out of the Weaver house, past the laughing girls, half of them singing, voices lifting to the rafters, their feet tapping under tables, the pink pulsating karaoke machine humming at their painted feet, she was gone. She was gone and no one saw. Running the mile home, her chest tight and punishing, she couldn't get there fast enough. Except Drew was in the garage doing something with his science project, and he was always trying to catch her. Hiding behind the tool bench, she waited until he left, then grabbed Dad's keys on the hook just inside the kitchen door. She'd only done it 3 times before, and once she'd had to stop to figure out how to turn on the headlights. She wasn't thinking as she drove there. She couldn't make her brain stop worrying long enough to think. The signs seemed to jump out at her. Ash Road. They were both sitting up now, Devin taking little breaths.
Mom, it happened so fast, she finally said,
her voice small as when she was a child having a nightmare. The kind when even after Katie thought she'd wakened her, she could tell Devin was still seeing it, her eyes dancing under her lids.
You can tell me, Katie said, grabbing for her hand. It was darker than it had ever been before. Devin said, shaking her head. I couldn't tell where the road ended and the rest began.
I didn't know how to make the lights go bright enough.
Oh, honey, Katie said.
Devin leaned against her arm, her mouth inches from her mother's ear.
Suddenly he was there,
Devin said,
and I didn't turn the wheel fast enough.
A rush of feelings came, every feeling all at once, Katie's stomach turning.
My foot, never. It was so fast, and then it was too late,
Devin said.
I don't even remember getting home.
Oh, Devin.
Mom, I swear, it was darker than it had ever been.
They didn't say anything, or even move, for what felt like a long time.
You were lying then, Katie said finally. About Haley's texts, her calls, the things she said. You let me believe your dad.
I'm a murderer,
Devin said. The words so big neither of them could speak for a moment. Katie couldn't order her thoughts. None of it seemed real. The comforter bunching in her hands. But she knew whatever she said next would decide the course of everything.
You're not a murderer, she said, the words soft in her mouth. That's not what this is.
Mom, I am. I just kept going. I didn't stop. I didn't do anything. I froze.
No, Katie said, a growing force in her voice. It was an accident. It was a terrible accident. There are accidents, and we can't always stop them, and it's no one's fault.
It is my fault. I'm a monster,
she said, turning. Her face so old, Katie didn't recognize it, small and stretched and old.
Because I'm not sorry enough. I missed him, but I'm free. He might have taken it all away.
That's not true, Katie interrupted. I know it's complicated, but you really don't...
You never want to hear what it's like being me,
she whispered.
What?
Katie asked.
What do you mean?
But Devin didn't seem to be listening, her face in her hands now. They sat for a second, a draft nudging the door open. Katie could hear Drew's deep-throaty breathing down the hall, the walls humming with it. And she looked back at Devin, cross-legged on the bed, and reached out to touch her cheek. As she did, Devin's face seemed immediately to unlash itself, to grow tender and young and unruined. It was the face of a little girl sprawled on her bed, or the back lawn. Her foot caught beneath her.
I'm a monster, she repeated. I am.
No, Devin,
Katie said, pulling her close, her hands on her hair, smoothing it.
You're my girl. You're our girl. You're mine.
There were so many things she and Eric had tried to buffer Devin from. The shocks and trauma of the world, anything that might distract her, hurt her. The gym and her home were both siloed tight, the floors padded, all the noises of the world sucked out. Also Devin could stand, beam, runway, corner of mat, and only hear the sound of her own breath, her own heart beating, only see the air, the air and ground again. Only worry about herself. Which is what all parents want to do for their children, after all. All of Devin's life, she'd been nestled in that amniotic swirl, the swirl she inhaled and exhaled, nestled, smothered, choked. By her parents. Wasn't that right? And the minute she'd forced her way out, kicking spastically at all corners, then sucked out by the grappling hooks of that handsome boy, she hadn't known what to do, how to live in this world. Everything had been too much. She hadn't learned. No one had taught her. Katie and Eric hadn't taught her that the things you want, you never get them. And if you do, they're not what you thought they'd be. But you'd still do anything to keep them. Because you'd wanted them for so long. Part 5. I could hear thousands of eyes watching us. Nadia Komenich, Letters to a Young Gymnast. Chapter 22. There were three things Devin would never tell her mother. The first was what Mrs. Weaver had said before she left Lacey's birthday party that night.
Sneaking out of one of the half-dozen bedrooms, Devon felt a hand on her shoulder. There was Mrs. Weaver, and Devon knew she'd heard her on the phone with Ryan. Had heard everything. For a second, Devon thought it was all over, and in some way she was relieved. That everyone would know, and it wouldn't be hers anymore. But instead, Mrs. Weaver just shook her head and said, in the iciest of voices, "I hope your mother never has to know this." The second thing she'd never tell her mother was what happened after, when she saw Ryan on Ash Road that night. Driving, hardly breathing at all but almost flying, she thought,
"My life is ending. My life is over."
Once Ryan had asked her if she ever thought about him when she was on the floor, the beam. Of course she never did, and never would. It was a place she would never let him in.
"Single-mindedness," Coach T always told her, "is the greatest of your great gifts."
But that was when she'd known she'd never feel for him what he felt for her. There was not enough space in her heart. Her heart was different. She was different. This is what she knew. You win or lose everything with a flick of the wrist, a turn of the ankle, not enough lift, a slipped hand on the beam. And everything changes. Everything goes dark. And is gone.
"What if we just tell everyone? Won't it be wonderful?"
he'd said, even as he knew she was pulling away. Because he knew she was pulling away. She'd turned on the high beams. All the dust and sand and road salt gathering up into the air. The hot yellow of the center line like an arrow straight to him. Headlights struck, face like blasted marble and eyes filled with love. He was the most beautiful thing she'd ever seen. Her hands on the wheel, for a second she thought,
"Forget what Dad said. What Mrs. Weaver said. What anyone thinks."
He was so beautiful. What did anything else matter? Strange that it was in that moment that she did it. The moment she made the turn and saw him waiting for her, waving to her, seeing him so rapturously handsome, lit by her headlights. That great golden flame of a face. Standing at the fog line, his feet planted on the shoulder, waving to her, slowly waving, his arm swaying. That was the moment she...
"You must be in control of your landing," that's what Coach always said.
Bounding down the vault runway, feet hit springboard, hands hit table, the push, flying through the air, soaring, a spinning weightlessness, arrowing down, the surge of feet to ground, body electric. Thump, thwack, smack. And she felt it, down there. The ancient throb in her foot, that foot, blood surging, pressing down on the gas.
"There's 100 ways sex can ruin you."
The words came to her in that moment, a thunderclap in her head. Her mouth made a funny noise, and she felt a twinge over her heart, but not enough to stop her. At least not in time. Her arms jerked, the wheel seized. He was there in front of her, waving and smiling. For a second, the white tail of his shirt, like a bird flying. And she shut her eyes. Her right foot throbbing, she plunged it downward onto the pedal. He was there. And then he was gone. Then there was the third thing she'd never tell. Which was how it really began with Ryan. What had started it for her. It was back in January, the night after regionals, a big booster party, tiki torches, some of the girls sneaking sips of coconut rum from white bottles, smooth as milk. Her head doing starbursts when she closed her eyes.
"Air, air, air," she thought. "I am, I am, I am."
Which is what she always said when she was on the vault runway. It cleared her. The flowers tickled her neck and smelled like the inside of Mrs. Weaver's car. The all-around gold medal beneath it, cold against her hot chest, her hand pressed there.
"You made us so proud," her dad told her. "But you always do,"
kissing the top of her head. And a song came on through the popping speakers, something about a girl with a blister on her hand, that felt like it was just for her.
"It will be like this forever,"
she was saying in her head.
"It will feel this way. Forever."
That's when she saw it. The dance floor crushed,
and impossible. And in a far corner by the swinging doors to the kitchen, a ponytailed woman with her hand on a man's hip. She blinked once, then twice, because it had to be the coconut rum swirling. Except it wasn't, because the woman with the ponytail was Mom, and the man was Ryan Beck, Haley's boyfriend. Ryan, the one all the girls always talked about. And she'd never really looked at him. Even the time he found her retainer, held it right in his hand. She never looked because it felt like she shouldn't, like staring into the sun. Her mom did sometimes, at the booster events, at Weaver's Wagon where he worked. The night they'd all stayed at the Ramada, the way she'd watched him down at the pool. "Oh my God," her mom was saying now, her eyes wide, her hand jumping back to her mouth. "I thought you were my husband." Ryan Beck's smile, easy and loose and open. "I bet that's what they all say to you," her mom said. And then both of them were laughing, and it didn't seem like her mom at all. One strap on her dress, slipping down her shoulder, golden under the grease-slicked light feature, a glass bowl glowing over their heads. Her mom looked so young, which was strange because she wasn't. Something, and not just the Mai Tais, because she'd seen her mom like that before, was making her cheeks look brighter. Making her body move differently, fluidly, freshly. Everything different from the ordered, slunk-shouldered, hank-haired mother she was. That something was in her mom. Was it the thing she saw in the girls at school, the ones who showed off mesh bras and metallic thongs, whispering to one another of feelings and mysteries, belt buckles under blankets, and the tastes of things, and that look on their faces? And when they saw the boy from the night before, or the one who just might be that night. It felt like a secret kept from her whole life. Like, you're adopted. You have a brother you've never met. Your father isn't dead. He's in prison. How come no one told me? Your mom, secretly at night, turns into this. And so do other women. Other girls. Just not you. All of them except you. How come everyone hid it from me? How come Mom did? She watched them, their faces pressed close because of the swinging door behind them or because of this thing, this conspicuous energy, practically glowing. And she could have sworn that when her mother was laughing and leaning close, her mouth pushed against Ryan Beck's cheek, even his tanned neck, and the kitchen door swinging and pressing them close. And then her mom asking for a cigarette. But she never smoked, not ever, and as he went to light it for her, her hand leaped out, grabbing for something. The paperback with the red cover shoved in his back pocket. Ryan's eyes went wide with surprise. A grin there. Devin couldn't believe she'd seen it. Her mom's hand in his pocket. And both of them laughing, and the song ending. And then she saw her mom leap back as if touching a flame. "Oh," covering her mouth again. Repeating with a wink this time, "I thought you were my husband." In the ladies' room, Dominique Plonsky heaved coconut pudding, slippery tongues of guava, spattering Devin's brand new metallic open-toe pumps for which her dad had paid $40.
"I don't know what happened,"
Dominique kept saying, her little body shaking from it.
"You can't eat food like that,"
Devin said, looking down at her silver shoes, ruined.
"Your body doesn't know how."
After leaning against the dumpster behind the restaurant, a wet paper towel in hand, she took off her shoes, her lei. It was then she saw Ryan, ducked behind the dumpster, smiling at her and smoking a cigarette. She decided she would talk to him, which she never had.
"I didn't know you smoked," she said,
her voice embarrassingly high.
"I gave it up 100 years ago, he said. "But we all have our secrets."
But what should she say next?
"Don't hide it," he said,
catching her hiding her foot behind her other foot. Her right foot, its lump inside, the soft pad, its split thickness. Her Frankenfoot, that's what her mom used to call it until her dad made her stop. Thank God he made her stop. But her dad, sometimes it felt like he never stopped looking at it. Her foot, that foot. It was more theirs than hers. It's ugly, she said. I hate it.
I doubt that, he smiled.
You shouldn't smoke, she said, then blurted. And you should stay away from the moms. And he laughed, a loud bark, and nodded his head yes.
Okay, he said.
And he looked down at her foot again, and it was like he could see it pulsing like a second heart. She knew he could. And he was right. It was beautiful. Chapter 23. Elite Qualifiers, 1 month later. The four of them walked into the conference center, the Qualifiers Day 1 of 2 Ballroom B sign rippling above them over the bank of doors. The four of them, Eric's hand squeezing Devin's shoulder, Drew wheeling the mini cooler, Katie hauling Devin's gym bag, walked inside. And they were ready. And Katie looked at her daughter, her hard, small little body, her muscled neck, the blankness in her eyes, shades drawn. No one could peek through. No one. We'll take her from here, the blonde official with the lanyard said, clasping Devin by the shoulders. There was no grandstand, no booming sound system, no grease-lined concessions or foil balloon banks or sponsor banners. No bleachers, even. Just a set of risers clotted with parents, fists knotted with nerves. It was just another convention center. Dropped ceiling, 30,000 feet of industrial floor divided into quadrants, long tables and metal folding chairs in the middle, between the beams and bars, judges seated there, styrofoam coffee cups in hand, watching. A few officials were milling around and coaches walking their girls, hands to shoulders, patting their hard little backs, the shells of baby turtles. A tracksuited volunteer dragging a springboard across the floor as a girl hinged into a handstand, turning hypnotically on the beam, releasing a smattering of claps from the risers. In one corner, a purple leotarded sylph slashed her legs through a floor routine as a boombox echoed wanly. On a tumbling strip, another rubbed her hands frantically, counting in her head. The smack, smack, smack of the vault. Farther down on the risers, an unshaven father, arms across his chest, looked like he might be praying. The night before, all the booster parents had assembled at Gwen's house, their faces gray and hoary from 4 weeks of punishing driving schedules, the pit-foamed air of the gym, the pre-competition hysteria of gym-juries, overworked girls jamming fingers, rolling ankles, popping knees. Molly Chu, 12 pounds thinner from nerves, her cheeks hollow, kept sliding antacids under her tongue. Becca Plonsky's hands cradled her jaw, which ached from gum-chewing, teeth grinding. But there was something else on all their faces, too. That feeling of being on the cusp, like generals on the brink of battle, bunkered deep in the Pentagon war room. It was probably superstition, then, that no one wanted to talk about anything related to qualifiers, about their daughters least of all. Their daughters who were all at home, bodies Gordian knotted, hunchbacked over gym videos, soaking in blood-blooming bathtubs, their feet and hands shredded. Instead, the parents gathered in one corner of Gwen's palatial living room, their minds fired and their bodies responding with beer pounding, overeating, and listening to a long, dirty story from Jim Chu about the time his roommate supposedly slept with Mary Lou Retton. It was Kirsten Seifert who brought out the joint, swiped from her son's backpack, and they shared it, even Molly, who said, red-faced, that pot made her erotic. Eyes twitching and nostrils flared, Gwen tried to talk shop, but no one would join her. Katie herself had not said one word to her since their conversation at Weaver's Wagon. They glided past each other with the hooded eyes of those who'd shared a mortifying one-night stand. Finally, Gwen surrendered to the group, the gym parent equivalent of a key party, returning from her kitchen, brandishing a bottle of tequila in the shape of a skull, looking like she wanted to throw back the bottle and swallow the worm whole. "Who's feeling dangerous?" she asked, in her tall boots, the kind you might ride in. "Where's the crop?" Jim Chu had laughed, and kept laughing, even as his smile fell, Gwen's gaze on him. The boots were magnificent and worn,
and when she walked in them, she looked taller, stronger, younger, prettier. A picture came into Katie's head. Gwen at 15 or